Well done. Well, thank you, Michael. That was fantastic to hear. And your focus and conversation on things like education, healthcare, local roads is great to hear. One of the things you touched on is privatisation and your view of where that's gone with the Liberals. Interested, particularly given your brethren down south being Labor and that they have continued to embrace privatisation to release capital to then invest in infrastructure and essential services. What is your view then, specifically as it relates to privatisation and public-private partnerships?
Well, privatisation is not popular in New South Wales now, and you can't say that after $70 billion we should do more of it. $70 billion is enough. We will not privatise any further assets. The Victorians did a much better job at managing their regime than the Baird and Berejiklian government did. If you look at the sale of the ports down there, they got a higher proceed of sale from the sale of their ports for 50 years than we did here in 99 years, and the output wasn't as high. Enough to privatisation. It's deeply unpopular. If you're talking about further privatisations, it means you've got to start selling things like Sydney Water, start selling buses and trains, and there'll be nothing left to sell one day. There'll be no more privatisations under Labor.
Thank you. I'm going to open it up to the floor, given that time is tight. Gentlemen there. If you don't mind saying your name and where you're from, that would be great.
Simon Smith from OLA. What would a future New South Wales Labor government's approach be towards the gig economy?
Well, the gig economy is something that arrived whether we liked it or not, and it's made life fun. I've got a phone full of many, many apps here and use it mercilessly, and we all enjoy it, and it's convenient, and it's quick, and it's transformed our lives. But when I was studying law, I remember a case, I think it was medical negligence, where one of the justices in the House of Lords said that the law always lags 20 years behind societal developments. And that's what's happened with workers in the gig economy now. It's taken off, it's arrived, but what we've seen now is that some of the workers have really been left behind. And we spoke to some people who worked for one of the food delivery companies the other day, and they really have nothing to take care of them. There are no entitlements to leave, sick leave, superannuation. All of those protections that we all take for granted on a day-to-day basis are all completely lacking in those sorts of industries. I spoke to an Uber driver one day who was doing about 70 hours a week. That was his permanent job. He had a fight with a customer, and with one email, they just switched him off. That can't be allowed to happen. So we will introduce standards for gig economy workers and allow them to go to the Industrial Relations Commission and have those benefits and entitlements that we take for granted in other industries apply to them as well. And I was asked a question, but won't that make your Chinese meal a bit more expensive? Well, at the moment, it's expensive anyway, and that the expense that is being applied through the gig economy has just been siphoned off to San Francisco anyway. I'd rather that they take a little bit less profit and put some back into the pot for their employees. It's just about treating people fairly. One of the things that we lament is, and I've got four kids, two of them in their 20s, very, very hard for young people to get good permanent jobs. There's a lot of part-time, a lot of jobs out there that aren't permanent. If you're working in these gig economy industries, and treating it as your full-time job, you need protections, and that's what we'll do.
Next question. Over here.
Hello, Tim Moore from Liverpool City Council. You've spoken a little about your concerns for spot rezoning and the different growth rates and development rates across Sydney. I just wonder if you could tell us anything you're thinking in relation to planning reform.
Oh, well, as dear to my heart as former shadow planning minister, and made some commitments to help you out with the busway to Badgerys Creek as well, $10 million, which is a terrific thing that you've worked up. Congratulations. Look, one of the things that this government promised to do, and you can picture Barry O'Farrell saying it, is, well, I want to return planning powers to the people. They've done exactly the opposite. And when I talk about business needing certainty, communities need certainty as well. You need to know that the laws that apply to you in your local area that say, here's the built form, here's what it will look like for at least the next 5 years, have some rigour about them. And what this government done is taken planning powers away from the people. So let me give you a really good example. In my area of Randwick, there's a whole corridor down Anzac Parade that the light rail's going down. And there's a provision that allows developers to put an application in to councils now for something that is prohibited under their LEP. And the council has to go through all the expense and rigmarole of using ratepayers' money to assess these applications, even though they're doomed to fail. And then they refuse them and the developer says, thanks very much, I'm not going to go behind your back and take that to the Minister for Planning through the pre-gateway approval and see if we can get it approved anyway. So we went in to visit the Minister for Planning with the local council and said, why are you allowing all these applications in along Anzac Parade to go behind council's backs? And his words to us were, well, you're getting a light rail out there, you should take some of the pain as well. And if you don't massively rezone the heights and densities along Anzac Parade, I will, and I'll never forget the words, I will let a rip. I will let the developers rip. I've still got the handwritten notes. In other words, what your council determines through their LEP process, the certainty that your community has received through that process of consultation when your locally elected councillors come up with their local environmental plan will be subverted to whatever I want it to be, and it's subordinate to what the local council has said. Now, I understand that there are some councils who are recalcitrant, who don't want any high-rise in their area. We'll fix that by getting the Greater Sydney Commission to recut their targets and make sure that there is density applied fairly across the city. And we'll make sure that we fix the connection between the district plan and the LEP by having the Greater Sydney Commission sit down with the councils on a regional basis and do all that. But I'm not about to say that business deserves certainty and communities don't, and that developers should be able to run around behind councils and go to the Minister for Planning and subvert that process. We won't have spot rezonings. It won't be the case. The LEP will apply. And if there's a change in use in a big industrial area that needs to be redeveloped, and there always will be a need for that in Sydney, you can go along and argue it with the council at the time the LEP, and the Greater Sydney Commission at the time the LEP has been done. But citizens deserve certainty just as much as business does, and that's what's underpinned that announcement.
Thank you.
Christian Colding, Deloitte Access Economics. Thank you for your enlightening presentation earlier. You spoke a lot about the expenditure side of the budget, where money is going, where it might go in the future. I was quite interested to hear about your thoughts on the revenue side. Any thoughts on the tax system and potential changes to the state tax system?
No. The states are hamstrung by the fact that our revenue sources have diminished in number over the years. We used to be able to levy excise. Remember the 3x3? That's gone. Relied pretty heavily on stamp duty and now are really supplicants to the federal government. So it's good to see that the federal government's revenues are now improving to the point where it's returning to surplus, and I would expect that a good portion of that would be delivered back to the states. Considering that it's Sydney and Melbourne that really take the brunt of immigration into the nation. I think somewhere like 85% of immigrants come to live in Sydney and Melbourne. We wish they'd also go into other places that are crying out for people like South Australia. But the increase in productivity that's derived from immigration, and no one doubts that there is largely represented by increased tax receipts in the hands of the Commonwealth. So in this imperfect taxation system that we had in the federal sphere, with that increase in population and the recovery in revenues from the federal government, we'd expect that they would return more funds to the states to do the heavy lifting in terms of transport and infrastructure. And one of the things I said to the Committee for Sydney last year when I delivered a speech to them on this very point was we don't want Sydney to approach the point where it's desperately uncomfortable to live in and then think about how to look outside the I think I call them the cradling hills, but they might be another term might be used. There will come a time when we have to seriously explore things like very fast trains, high-speed rail, whatever you want to call them. I'm not nominating a mode today, but they can only be done with the assistance of the federal government. They are well beyond the expenditure of state governments. They will need to be done for the long term, but if the federal government doesn't kick into projects like that, they will not happen.
Yes, thank you.
Greg Storey, Sustainable Energy Partners. Thank you for your address. You highlighted your policy to encourage production of more renewable energy by providing further subsidies and incentives. That alone will simply lead to an increase in electricity bills, but will not necessarily lead to a reduction in CO2 emissions. What is required to lower CO2 emissions is to store that renewable energy to affect load shifting. Do you have a policy around that?
Yeah, we're going to create a new state-owned corporation to work with the industry to lead the way on storage. And the part of the reverse auction system I spoke about where it's been done successfully in jurisdictions overseas, they're doing it in Victoria now. ACT has led the way on it in Australia. The Queensland government are using that system as well. We're confident that that can lower electricity prices. It should. It will, in my view. But we'll also use a reverse auction system to have people invest in batteries as well. Renewable energy plus battery is a game changer. That's where we have to head to. There will not be any further investment in coal-fired power in New South Wales. I agree with you on that.
We've probably got time for one last question. Is there a last question? Nope, I'll take that as an opportunity to to wind up. So on behalf of First State Super, CEDA and everyone here in the audience, thank you, Michael, for a really interesting address and Q&A session. It was fantastic to hear your perspectives on a number of issues, whether that be renewables and storage, investing more in TAFE, in education and housing. I certainly know from a First State Super perspective where our members are many in the public sector, education, housing. These are matters of great importance to the community. So thank you very much for joining us today, and we wish you all the best in the upcoming election. Thank you. Thank you.